If you would, make your way to Judges chapter 17. We'll be reading the first five verses in a moment. Didn't know that I was your first choice on this, Dove. When you called, I had this program in front of me, and they're in alphabetical order, and I'm S on the last row, and I just thought, boy, Dubs had a hard time getting anyone else to agree. So he's about to the end of the alphabet, so I said, well, all right. I know you're disappointed that Brother Music is not got the health that he needs in order to be here. We're grateful that his manuscript is in the book, and I commend that to you. I've enjoyed reading the things that he has written. Behold, the pattern is... Well, just the amount that it has sold speaks highly enough for it without hardly needing any other words of praise. And so I'm sure we're all disappointed, and I'm persuaded that if he were here to present that manuscript in the book, it would be an outstanding one. But let's turn to Micah, the story of Micah, in Judges chapter 17. There are three things we'd like to talk about concerning him: his family life, his spiritual life, and the loss of his religion. In verses 1 through 5 we read, "And there was a man of Mount Ephraim, whose name was Micah. And he said unto his mother, The 1,100 shekels of silver which were taken from thee, about which thou cursedst, and spakest of also in mine ears, behold, the silver is with me, I took it. And his mother said, Blessed be thou of the Lord, my son. And when he had restored the 1,100 shekels of silver to his mother said, I had wholly dedicated the silver unto the Lord from my hand for my son, to make a graven image and a molten image. Now therefore, I restore it unto thee. Yet he restored the money unto his mother, and his mother took 200 shekels of silver and gave them to the founder who made thereof a graven image and a molten image. And they were in the house of Micah. And the man Micah had a house of gods, and made an ephod and teraphim, and consecrated one of his sons, who became his priest." In these first five verses, we have quite a few things that we are told about the times and the man Micah. I suppose one of the first questions we would want to ask is, when did these events take place? Because they are not necessarily chronological. And as we look at what we have just read with the stealing and the other things that are going on, we would probably want to say, surely this took place before the giving of the Ten Commandments, but sadly it did not. It took place afterward. It took place after Moses had led the children of Israel for 40 years. It took place after the leadership of Joshua, and we don't know specifically how long after. Some estimate between 50 and 100 years later, this event takes place. The immoralities are, well, not as shocking as what you'll find in the last three chapters, but still surprising to say the least. Why does Micah steal from his mother? Why would a son do that? Was it because he wanted an early inheritance, and she was not giving him what she had, just hoarding all the money up for herself? What did he hope to gain by stealing it? How could he go out and spend it without her being just a little bit suspicious? This is a large sum of money. What did he hope to gain by this? How did he hope to not be found out? The text doesn't give us any of those answers. We can only wonder about some of those things. But one thing is sure, both the mother and Micah love money. Paul would write centuries later in 1 Timothy 6:10, "For the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil." And certainly we see that here. Prompted to steal from his own mother that amount of 1,100 pieces of silver, which amounts to about several thousand dollars. Why did he do it? Well, we don't know. But we know why he gave it back. Because she pronounced a curse. Now, when you read this verse, and he says, "Mother, I took it," and she immediately says, "Blessed be thou of the Lord, my son," doesn't that strike you as a little unusual? I can think of a lot of things that a parent might say to a child who have done that, but that wouldn't be at the top of the list. She would have a right to say a lot of other things to him. Why does she say that? Because in this day and time, to call down a curse as she did was thought to have the power to do serious damage to the one who had, in this case, stolen the money. In other words, she was not just blowing off steam and rattling around saying a bunch of negative things. She was actually invoking God to bring evil upon the one who stole her money. Then she finds out it's her son. Well, she may have felt badly that he had done that, but she needed to recall the curse that she had uttered, which would have fallen upon her son. And that's why she then does the very opposite of what she had initially done. The Lord bless you. A few moments ago, she was saying, "The Lord curse whoever took this," but since it was her son, that became "The Lord bless you," in an effort to remove the curse. Her God was money long before the idol was made, and so was Micah. You can see what is valued by these two people. Perhaps he got the idea for his covetousness from his mother. But they worshipped, apparently, money, and I don't know where she got such a large sum of money either. But she had it, and he wanted it. They both loved it, and they made an idol out of it. Now, we notice in the passage that she says, "I'm going to wholly dedicate this money to the Lord." And so he gives her the 1,100 back, and the text says she spent then 200. Well, you don't have to be really good at math to see a 900 pieces of silver discrepancy in that particular place. Some have suggested, well, maybe this was an additional 200. The 1,100 was given to making the idols, but she had another 200 and paid the person to make them. But there's no evidence that she had an additional stash of money anywhere. Maybe she vowed to give it all to the Lord, but then withheld it. It would not be the first time someone had promised God more than they delivered. Or maybe there's another possibility, and that is that the remainder of the 1,100 was used for the house of God's, the teraphim, and some of the other things that are mentioned. After verse 4, the mother drops out of sight. She's not mentioned again. She is there, and the reader has learned some things about her and about how this situation got its beginning. We have learned the origin of the wealth that provided the money to create the idols, the house of gods that Micah constructed. And he sets up his own house of worship. And not everybody can afford that. But now we see how that came about. Well, let's talk next about Micah and his religion. Beginning with where we leave off, verses 4 and 5, we see the creation of these idols and the establishment of the house of God. When we talk about these idols, we probably have something in the form of a bull. It's the same phraseology, some of the same words are used that are used in Exodus chapter 32 and verse 24. As Moses comes down from the mount and sees the golden calf. It's the same term that's used in 1 Kings chapter 12 and verse 29, as we read that Jeroboam set up the two golden calves. And so this is probably a golden calf. Well, they would have had a historical precedent for this with what was done while Moses was on the mount. But they got these ideas from the people around them. This was never part of God's system. So he makes this house of gods, a private shrine for his own personal use. Judges chapter 18 and verse 31 tells us that there was a house of God that was in Shiloh. All the time there was a house of God in Shiloh. Did he really need this? Had the Lord commanded it? No. But he wanted it for his own personal use. After all, this is a lot more convenient. Why go to another city or why go anywhere when you can just have your own worship center right where you live? Also, there's a factor of control. When you own the worship center and you own the idols and you've established the house of God, you have control over just about everything. That is convenient, isn't it? He made an ephod for a priest. The priest did make wear those. They were basically short garments without sleeves. Also mentioned in verse 5 are teraphim, which are small household gods. You may remember from Genesis chapter 31 and verse 19 that Rachel stole the household gods from her family. Those are teraphim. Same thing as what we have mentioned here. Why did people have household gods? If you've studied Greece or Rome or some of the other ancient civilizations which are after this time period, you'll know that it's a common thing. Almost every false religion has not only the big deities, but the smaller ones that govern the household. The Romans had them. But here we go way back, and we find this practice even here. What were the household gods supposed to do? Well, they were supposed to be the givers of earthly prosperity. You had those household gods, and you took care of them, and you prospered. Credit was given to them. They were also considered sources of divine knowledge. And that's undoubtedly some of the reasons why Rachel's family was so upset when she took off with them. Also, whoever possessed them was the part of the family that was in charge. There was the patriarch. Again, in Judges 17:5, we see that he consecrated his son as a priest. But in Judges chapter 17, verses 7 through 13, we find that he was able to go a step better. He was able to procure a Levite. Let's notice the verses that are written here. Verses 7 and 8, "And there was a young man out of Bethlehem, Judah, of the family of Judah, who was a Levite, and he sojourned there. And the man departed out of the city from Bethlehem, Judah, to sojourn where he could find a place, and he came to Mount Ephraim, to the house of Micah, as he journeyed." More questions that we really don't know. What was he doing? The Levites had usually been appointed cities. Was he an outcast? Was he a maverick? Was he restless? We don't know why he is where he is, but he comes to the house of Micah. The Levites were to be taken care of, Deuteronomy 12:19, strictly charged to be taken care of. So why is he out running around looking for some place? Who knows? But he comes to this house, and then in verses 9 and 10, we read that Micah said to him, "Whence comest thou?" And he said unto him, "I am a Levite of Bethlehem, Judah, and I go to sojourn where I may find a place." And Micah said unto him, "Dwell with me, and be unto me a father and a priest, and I will give thee 10 shekels of silver by the year, and a suit of apparel in thy victuals." So the Levite went in. I'm sure he was the finest Levite you could buy and pay for. And unfortunately, we have some of that ilk today. Isn't this the kind of person that is mentioned in Romans chapter 16, verses 17 and 18, where we are encouraged and admonished to mark them which cause division and offenses contrary to the doctrine which you have learned, and avoid them, for they are that are such serve not our Lord Jesus Christ, but their own belly. That's what this Levite is. Make him a good offer. Offer to feed him. Give him some clothes. Give him a little spending money. And you got the sale. Bought and paid for. Isn't this the kind of person that we read about in 2 Timothy chapter 4, verses 3 and 4? The kind who has itching ears, the kind who just wants people to scratch. He'll say what they want to hear. Yes, that's what this person is. You want to inquire of the Lord? Fine. I'll tell you what the Lord says, and it'll be the message you want to hear. That's the kind of individual we're dealing with this Levite. So he buys them. It's a sad thing that something like this happens. I mean, God has given His holy law with how things ought to be done, and you think, surely this is not going to happen, but it does. And then we might say to ourselves, but in the New Testament, now we've got the last revelation of God to mankind. Surely this is not going to happen in the New Testament system, but sadly it does. There are always people willing to be bought and sold for a price. Just like the Levite. The problem is, when you buy and pay for someone, he may go to a higher bidder. Verses 11 and 12. And the Levite was content to dwell with the man, and the young man was unto him as one of his sons. And Micah consecrated the Levite, and the young man became his priest and was in the house of Micah. Treats him like a son and consecrates him. But after we have read all of these verses, the question is, how can all of this happen in light of the many violations of the law of Moses? How in so short a time as 50 or 100 years after the death of Moses and then after the death of Joshua, how in such a short time can people be so far removed from God and from His law? Let's look at a few commandments. You shall not covet. But he coveted the silver of his mother, Exodus 20:17. You shall not steal, Exodus 20:15. But he stole the money from his mother. And by the way, he would also be stolen from, Judges 18:24. We'll get to in a little bit. More stealing goes on. What about Exodus chapter 20 and verse 12? Honor your father and your mother. Is that honoring one's parents to steal the money that they have? Of course, some in the New Testament were trying to get out of their responsibility in Matthew chapter 15 by saying the word korban. They said, this is devoted to God. Sorry, folks, you don't get anything. And so they tried to get around the command of God in Exodus by their own traditions, their own reasoning, which was full of fallacies. But here, this man didn't go to any elaborate means. He just flat out stole it, thus dishonoring his mother. What other commandments are there? Exodus chapter 24, you shall not make any graven image. Well, they did, didn't they? Exodus chapter 20 and verse 3, you shall have no other gods, and yet they have household gods. Those are other gods. That one's broken. Exodus chapter 20 and verse 13. Now let's look at verse 7 first. Exodus chapter 20 and verse 7. If she made a promise to take the 1,100 and devote it wholly to God and then only spent 200, would you say that might fall under the category of taking the Lord's name in vain? Lord, I am promising this to you, and then not keeping it. Or Exodus chapter 20 and verse 13, you shall not kill. Now, we haven't come to that, but it's implied in Judges 18 and verse 25, and we'll get to that in a little bit. But there are more questions that we could ask. Besides all of these direct violations of the Ten Commandments, what about this? By whose authority did he make his son, an Ephraimite, a priest? Jesus couldn't even be a priest because he was of the tribe of Judah. And concerning that tribe, Moses spake nothing. Hebrews 7:14. Moses spake nothing about an Ephraimite being a priest either. Where did he get the authority to do that? He didn't have it from God. And by whose authority did he, an Ephraimite, consecrate either his son or the Levite as his own personal priest? Where did he get the ability to do consecration? No authority for it. And so again, we come back to the question, how could all of this happen? How could all of these things happen when God had given His holy law at Mount Sinai and instructed everyone to present the law to their children and to teach them diligently? Deuteronomy chapter 6, verses 4 through 9. Judges 17:6 is a key point to answer this. In those days there was no king in Israel. Every man did that which was right in his own eyes. That explains why all of these things happen. And it's an important phrase that is found in these last five chapters in the book of Judges. Not only do we have it here in Judges 17:6, but we have at the beginning of chapter 18 with the incident with the Danites. In those days there was no king of Israel in Israel. When we move to chapter 19 to discuss the last episode of the book of Judges, chapter 19 and verse 1, it came to pass in those days there was no king in Israel. And the book ends in Judges chapter 21 at the close of that sordid incident. And verse 25, again, in those days there was no king in Israel. Every man did that which was right in his own eyes. What is the purpose of these five chapters? What are we to understand? That these things happen, it seems implied, because there was no strong, positive, decisive, continuous spiritual leadership. And the church suffers when the same thing is lacking today. God must have positive, strong, decisive, spiritual leaders, or you end up with messes like this. There were some judges that arose, obviously, throughout the book, but the leadership did not continue. They always fell back into sin, repeating the cycle. Those leaders need to, as 2 Timothy 2:2 says, need to train other men who will teach others also. The cycle must be ongoing so that there's continuous good leadership. But like many today, Micah makes his religion to suit himself. He does not hesitate to break half of the Ten Commandments, but he is careful to get a Levite as a priest. He violates stealing and idolatry, but he's careful to find an ephod for the priest to wear. Reminds me of a man, and I'm not trying to pick on any race. This man just happened to be a Jew, and he just happened to own the building of a place where I used to work, and so he was around quite a bit of the time. I overheard him one day complaining about the high price of kosher food. Oh, they're trying to gyp us. Oh, they're trying to fleece us. You can't get kosher food anywhere. You got to pay a high price for it. Real concerned about the dietary laws, but then you'd often hear him taking the Lord's name in vain and swearing constantly. Now, what kind of sense does that make? To violate one of the Ten Commandments and then be concerned about a dietary law. It doesn't make any sense, but that's the way people often are. That's the way Micah is. And like many in our day, Micah believes that man is the measure of all things. Religion is not objective for him. It is subjective. Whatever he wants to make out of it is what it is. What he agrees with is fine, and if he disagrees with it, well, just don't worry about it. Don't bother about it. Man is arrogant enough to try and sit in judgment on the Word of God, but the fact is that the Word of God is going to sit in judgment on us. Jesus said, "He that rejects my word receives not my teaching, has one that judges him. The word that I have spoken, the same shall judge him in the last day." John 12:48. How proud and full of arrogance we are to try and sit in judgment on God and to decide whether the word is what it claims to be, or if it's maybe fully inspired, or whatever that term was you used, and some of the other stuff. We're going to be judged by it. We need to be in harmony with it, not fit it into our mold. But that's the way Micah was. Examples abound of men trying to make religion to suit themselves. We could talk about Cain. We could talk about Nadab and Abihu. We could talk about Jeroboam, who certainly made the religion what he wanted it to be instead of the way God had set it up. And on with all of those things. We could talk about some of the perversions that men have come up with in the worship. But let's just mention one: instrumental music. Instrumental music was never part of the worship of the church in the first century. It was added by men centuries later. And many arguments have been offered in behalf of it over the years, but there is only one truthful argument. If you got rid of all of the fluff and all of the pretension, there is only one real argument for instrumental music. I like it. That's what it all boils down to. You can have unity meetings from now till the Lord returns, but the argument is always going to be, I like it, and therefore I do it. If it causes division, I like it anyway. I'm going to have it. We have a new thing that has arisen, at least it's new for me. I just found out about this a week ago, attending a family workshop, and the person making the presentation began to enthusiastically encourage Christian parents to get their young people to listen to Christian rock music. He said, why, there's a group of 50 young people at White's Ferry Road that are really into it. Now, that's what he said. I don't have any first-hand knowledge. But even if there was, so what? Doesn't every sin creep in that way? Every sin begins with somebody doing it, and it's only a matter of time before you can say, well, you know, there's a congregation over there doing it, there's one over there, so what? What kind of an argument is that? Then he went ahead to give a testimonial. There was a young girl, he said, who was addicted to sex from the age of 15. And finally, after listening to Christian rock music for about a year, she got unhooked from it and is totally pure now. Imagine the power that that stuff must have. Isn't that exchanging just one sin for another? And if you heard that somebody was taking LSD and you happen to know that people have died taking LSD, that they have never come down from a trip and how deadly it is and the flashbacks that can occur, you know, would you say to somebody, oh, you shouldn't be taking LSD. Here, try marijuana. It's much better. Of course you would. You can't exchange one sin for another just because you perceive one to be less harmful than the other. And then this argument, which sounds like what the sex education experts have argued. Young people are going to listen to rock music. You can't stop them. They're going to do it. And so why not just replace some of those profane lyrics with wholesome words? And our young people will be better off. Of course, the way this presented is that it's either Two Live Crew or Christian rock music, which is a false dichotomy. There are other choices. For one thing, why don't we train young people to exercise discernment? Why don't we give them principles by which to operate so that when something is distasteful on the radio or the television or somebody where they're going to is telling off-color jokes, why can't we train them that I don't want to be a part of that, shut it off or leave? Make the decisions for themselves. I have some objections to offer to that, and I know some people are going to say, but we like it. That's not the authority. Number one, the phrase Christian rock is a misnomer. Rock music is secular. It's describing a kind of music that has a particular beat. Christianity and spiritual songs are spiritual. The two don't even mix. It seems like it's about like saying atheistic evolution or supernatural naturalism. The two are contradictory terms. Secondly, God did not authorize the use of instrumental music in our worship to Him. Ephesians 5:19 and Colossians 3:16 apply in or out of the assembly, so far as I can tell. They do not exclude one or the other. It to say that one is just in the assembly, and since it's outside the assembly is okay, is to make an argument that the Scriptures do not warrant. There is no justification for brethren to conclude that it is wrong to sing with musical accompaniment but only if we're in the building. If we're in the building, we can't do it, but if we're at home around a piano, it's okay. If we're at camp with a guitar, it's all right. Where do we get the authority for that? Where do the Scriptures delineate between those two types of positions? If it is unauthorized and therefore sinful for Christians to use musical accompaniment in singing psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, then can it be right to listen to others who do so? and to encourage others who are doing that. It seems to me that Brother Howard Horton this afternoon said something about stay separate, stay separate. Isn't that right? Wouldn't it be nice if just one time when the denominational world started a fad or a trend, our people might just be distinctive and not go along with it? But no, we've already got some brethren who are jumping out on the bandwagon, no pun intended, and just saying, boy, our young people, they ought to be involved in this Christian rock music. How long will it be before some of our young people come to us and say, hey, why don't we start our own band? And how much longer will it be before some young person or group of young people says, well, you know, we're listening to all of this stuff outside the church. We're going to these concerts. What's wrong with using it in the assembly? You have to be incredibly naive to think that this is not going to have some kind of an effect if we throw our support behind it. But again, the argument will be, I like it. Someone needs to come up with a logical argument, the conclusion of which is, it's all right, it's okay, it's permissible for young people to listen to and involve themselves in Christian rock music. I like it will not suffice. There are many other practices that could be cited, but Micah liked his own religion. He liked having it close by. He liked controlling it. He liked making it what he wanted it to be. But here's the really bizarre thing. Look at the last verse of Judges 17. Then said Micah, now know I that the Lord will do me good, seeing I have a Levite to my priest. After he makes out of religion what he wants, not only does he become satisfied, but he thinks God should be satisfied too. And that's the way many people are today, are they not? The Bible says that we should worship God in spirit and in truth. And not only does Joshua 24:14 indicate that, as Brother Mosier said today, but also 1 Samuel chapter 12 and verse 24 is another parallel passage with John 4:24 and Joshua 24:14. In that particular passage, we read, only fear the Lord and serve Him in truth with all your heart. So you've got in spirit and in truth, you've got in truth with all your heart, and you've got in sincerity and truth. All of those are parallel. In chapter 18, and we'll have to just summarize this, five men from the tribe of Dan come scouting. They're looking for an inheritance. They've already been given one, and I don't know why they're still looking. Maybe they didn't think it was good enough. Maybe it was too well defended. So they go out and they find a city which has no defense. These people simply have not thought that they needed any protection. Unfortunately, we have some churches about like that too. Jesus said, beware of false prophets which come to you in sheep's clothing, and you can't convince some people the wolves are out there. But they are. This city was unprotected. They decided to take it. Verses 11 through 13, they come to the house of Micah. Now the five men have already been there, but now the whole 600 warriors are there. And they decide to steal Micah's, well, everything. His house of gods, the teraphim, the ephod, the graven images, and the priest too. The priest comes out and says, what are you men doing? And they said, look, hold your tongue. Come with us. Why should you just be a servant of one man when you can serve a whole tribe? And this Levite who had been bought and paid for and who had been treated like one of Micah's sons said, okay, I'll be glad to go with you. So they go. Well, Micah and some neighbors come out after them. Let's read that part. Verses 22 through 26. And when they were a good way from the house of Micah, the men that were in the houses near to Micah's house were gathered together and overtook the children of Dan, and they cried unto the children of Dan. And they turned their faces and said unto Micah, what aileth thee that thou comest out with such a company? And he said, ye have taken away my gods, which I made, and the priest, and you are gone away, and what have I more? And what is this you say to me, what aileth thee? Thugs with a sense of humor. We don't know why you're coming out here. But they say in verse 25, let thy voice not be heard among us, lest angry fellows run upon thee, and thou lose thy life. with the lives of thy household. So they just threatened to kill him. In their view, might makes right. And so the stealing goes on, threat of murder goes on. They go up and take the city. We come to verse 30. The children of Dan set up a graven image, and Jonathan, the son of Gershom, the son of Manasseh, he and his sons were priests to the tribe of Dan until the day of the captivity of the land, and they set up Micah's graven image, which he made all the time that the house of God was in Shiloh. Let's go back to verse 24, where they take away his gods. They stole his religion. I mean, when you see them taking the image and all of that, they're taking away his gods, they're taking away his religion. Have you ever seen someone lose their religion? What was their faith in? Was it in an object like an idol or even a church building? Was it in people? You ever notice someone, a husband or a wife dies and the mate doesn't come anymore? Was their faith in God or was it in that person? Is it in wealth? Is it in money? If people lose their money, do they just want to quit? If they lose their health, do they just want to give up, call Dr. Kevorkian and give it up? I don't have my health anymore. Life's not worth living. Was their faith in God or in their physical stamina? No one can steal God from you. No one can steal Jesus from you. No one can steal the Word from you. Well, they can take your Bible and burn it. But if you've stored it up and treasured it up in your heart as you should, they can't take it really away from you. No one can take away these things, even in persecution of Christians. Echoing biblical philosophy, Ignatius said, "May not of the things visible and the things invisible envy me, that I may attain unto Jesus Christ. Come fire and cross and grapplings with wild beasts, wrenching of bones, hacking of limbs, crushings of my whole body. Come cruel tortures or the devil till assail me. Only be it mine to attain unto Jesus Christ." In Psalm 18:1, David expressed it well. Psalm 18, verses 1 and 2. "I will love thee, O Lord, my strength. The Lord is my rock." You can't take David's God away by taking some idol. "The Lord is my rock and my fortress and my deliverer, my God, my strength, in whom I will trust. My buckler and the horn of my salvation and my high tower." Our faith must be in God. We should learn that lesson from these two chapters concerning Micah. Our faith should not be in silver. It should not be in idols. It should not be in a priest or some man. It should be in God. That's the only way to maintain a vital faith. Our worship must be in spirit and in truth. Thirdly, God set forth the objective word. And our religion should be on an objective basis, complying with the terms that God has set forth, not on our subjective feelings. And number four, we can be satisfied when, not when we are pleased, but when God is pleased. To Him be all authority and glory and power.